This talks about interventional cardiology, and a lot of you may say, "Well, why in the world would I need to be in a talk about this?" Well, if you're into providing the best care and the things that are out there, and being able to talk with clients about the advancements in veterinary medicine, you need to have an idea what are the things we're doing as far as advanced treatments of some of the cardiac diseases that are present out there. That oftentimes gets shunned by other cardiologists. They say, "Oh, you don't need to talk about that stuff." But I think it's good that you have a full understanding of what we're doing when we say, "Hey, we can do a catheter-based procedure." If you have a better understanding of that, you can talk with clients more freely, talk with them about the pros and cons of doing these procedures, and in the end, you're the biggest part of their care. In the end, you have that relationship that we don't really have with the clients, and you can give them the best advice. Most of the clients that I deal with, they always say, "Well, I'm going to go back and talk to my vet, Dr. Mike back home, and have him help me make a decision." And that's where your role in understanding these types of things comes to play significantly. Just as kind of my historical buff. The first cardiac catheterization actually occurred way back in 1800s when Claude Bernard catheterized the heart of a horse and issued in the era of cardiac physiology, and gave us a lot of principles of cardiac physiology, like pressure manometry and the Fick cardiac output method. All those things were developed based on some of his early works. And then Verna Forsman, who was actually a surgery resident at the time, or a surgery student is what they called him, he performed the first human cardiac catheterization on himself in 1929. As the story goes, he actually had a nurse, who probably got fired in the end, holding up a mirror while he was looking at the fluoroscopy screen, and he catheterized his antecubital vein and made it enter into the heart. Then, to make the story more amazing, he actually walked up a flight of steps, or several flights of steps, with the catheter in him, and this is the radiograph that he went to take of the catheter in his heart to prove that he was the first at doing it. Well, he was very obviously a very go-get-em type of resident, and what his goals were basically to be able to treat some of the diseases that he was seeing as a resident by catheter-based methods. He probably was a little bit too exuberant in that he actually ended up becoming a urologist rather than a cardiologist. So he still got to play with catheters, just a different. So Forsman's goal finally did come to fruition at some point in time as we started developing, scientists started developing more principles of the Fick methods, the development of technology such as capillary wedge pressure measurements, balloon catheters, the ability to retrograde catheterize the left heart. Seldinger technique issued in a number of different things. And then in 1967, the first PDA occlusion occurred in humans. And then in the early 70s, the Swan-Ganz catheters and the first angioplasties were performed. All of these issued in that era of being able to treat the heart without having to cut into it, into the chest, and catheter-based therapies. There we go. So some of the indications that we have as far as doing these procedures include a number of things that we need to think about. The first things we need to think about as far as indications is, do the benefits outweigh the risk to our patients? Meaning, are we just doing these techniques because we're having fun, we like doing them, this is the thing we like to do, or are we actually doing a better job at treating our patients than the gold standard that was there previously? Which is the second thing here that meets or exceeds our goals. And then these treatments also need to be cost effective in the end for our patients. Diagnostic catheterization historically was used in veterinary medicine to actually diagnose diseases. However, that's been superseded by echocardiography based on the fact that that's less invasive. You don't have to put the animal under anesthesia, and you get your answer just as quick, if not quicker, with this, actually quicker than you would if you had to do diagnostic catheterizations. They still have a place in some areas of pre-surgical screening for some cardiac diseases, especially if you're going to do procedures to correct diseases like tetralogy of Fallot, where you would basically create a PDA. You need to assess whether the pulmonary arteries in those animals are normal or not. And then therapeutic intervention has become the mainstay of using this technology or these techniques in patients. And then always, as far as clinical research is concerned, these techniques are invaluable. So again, the importance to you as people who are probably not doing these every day, how many of you have a fluoroscopy unit and catheters and stuff in there? I wouldn't either if I was in private practice. They're too expensive, and I don't even think I would have them if I was in a private specialty practice. Not many of those even have these things going on. So most universities do have these, but you have to understand the indications, the availability of these procedures, the usefulness and some of the limitations, and you're an invaluable part of informing owners about their available options to treat their patients. So it's very important for you to understand these procedures. A pacemaker therapy was probably one of the first interventional procedures that was done in veterinary medicine. As James Buchanan reported, the first clinical use of pacemakers in dogs in 1968. This was actually still a surgical treatment at the time. He did surgically placed epicardial leads in a dog. This dog actually lived for another 15 years, actually, before it died of cancer. So that's the ultimate cardiologist's goal, keep the animal alive till it can die of something else. Most of the cases we can't cure, so we try to keep a good quality of life. In 1985 was when the first surgical implanted pacemaker was reported in a cat. And in late 1980s, the first transvenous placement of endocardial pacemaker leads was reported by Peter Darker and also in the United States by Dave Sisson. Indications for pacemaker therapy include third-degree heart block, as you can see here. And we'll talk about these indications a little bit more on next session, where you have a P wave that is not tracking or causing a ventricular excitation. You have these ventricular escape rhythms here. This is theoretically in our minds was the most common cause in our patients, but in actuality, the most common cause that we saw for pacemakers in our patients was sixth sinus syndrome, where you have the Schnauzers, for example, develop an inability to depolarize the atrium. You end up with either ventricular or supraventricular escape rhythms that result in periods of tachycardia where you get and a syndrome of Brady and what we call a bradycardia tachycardia syndrome in these patients. Oftentimes they need a pacemaker to resolve the bradycardic signs, and they oftentimes also need antiarrhythmic drugs to squelch the supraventricular rhythms. And then about 8 cases had high grade second degree heart block. This is not a great example of high grade second degree. This just shows second degree heart block. But we have about 8 cases of those that needed pacemaker therapy. Other bradyarrhythmias that we've treated, sinus arrest and persistent atrial standstill in patients. Overall, any animal with a documented ECG abnormality and associated clinical signs probably going to require, as far as bradycardic treatment, a pacemaker. Pacemakers, I know some prior practitioners that do place pacemakers. They use their radiograph machine to help them do that. It's a fairly simple procedure in the end once you figure out what you're doing with it. But the pacemakers themselves come, we get the canisters. We get these donated from either cemeteries, funeral homes, from owners who request their pacemaker be used in patients, or more commonly we get expired shelf life human products. When the expiration date in human medicine is bypassed, they can't re-sterilize them, can't use them, they go back to the company, the company sells them to us at a cheaper cost, and we can pass that cheaper cost on to the client. You also have a lead system. The lead system is fairly expensive, as well as the canister. These two together are probably about $10,000 worth of equipment here. Fluoroscopy is invaluable in helping us place the leads. And then we have a programmer here for some of the higher-end pacemakers to help us make appropriate settings of our pacemaker in patients. The procedure itself basically requires general anesthesia. We do a cut down to the jugular veins. Most of our procedures, we place a temporary pacemaker in so we can take our time in doing this. And then we advance our leads into the jugular veins. And then the second portion of this is making an incision over the back and sliding the lead subcutaneously to meet the canister, which gets implanted in the back of the dog's neck. Some people use the side of the dog's neck here. We tend to put ours right between the scapula if we could, so that they can't really reach that area. There's two types of systems. Majority of veterinary cardiologists actually use a single lead system. The problem with this system is that it doesn't allow us to have good AV synchrony or to develop AV synchrony in our patients. So basically, you just pace the ventricles at a very fixed rate. So the heart rate can't be variable in these patients as they need it for when they sleep. The heart rate doesn't go down. It stays at that fixed rate. When they exercise, it stays at that fixed rate. So we actually put in most often now a dual lead system as long as it fits in these dogs. Small dogs are much more difficult to put that in, but we have much smaller lead systems that we've been able to do these in these guys. And what this system does is it allows us to track the normal sinus rhythm in that patient. And you can see here we have a P for every QRS on our ECG and a QRS for every P. So this P wave is actually coming from the normal sinus rate of this patient. We also have the ability in cases of sick sinus syndrome to actually pace the atrium if the heart rate gets too slow by using this system, so that we can pace it here and cause a P wave followed by a pace ventricular beat, which allows us to maintain AV synchrony. Now, it doesn't allow us variation to a certain extent. We'll set our lower rate limit to about 40 beats per minute sometimes in these guys so that it goes down when they're sleeping, but it doesn't go below that. If the animal's having clinical signs at 40 beats per minute, we raise it up to 60 beats per minute as the lower rate limit. But we still have that ability to track the animal's needs. And what we're seeing clinically in some of these dogs, especially our mitral regurgitation patients, is that this system tends to help them reduce some of the signs that result of having the combination of mitral regurgitation and the heart atrium contracting against a valve that's closed, which causes increased pressure. By us synchronizing the heart, we actually reduce the pressures within that chamber and reduce some of the atrial size in these guys. So it's really been a big benefit to be able to put this dual lead system in. The procedures take about 1 to 2 hours. Outpatients are usually, they come in the day before the procedure. They have the procedure the next day. They stay one night with us. They're discharged the following day with a wrap on it to prevent seroma formation. On prophylactic antibiotics for 7 days. The most important thing, and you're of invaluable help with this, is strictly confine these patients for 1 month. It's very important to do that because the types of lead systems that we put in actually are timed most often, have a time in on it that actually bites into the myocardium, and you want to give that time to fibrose in. If the animal's jumping around and playing, you're going to see that lead system come out in these guys. We check them in 1 month to make sure the leads are in place, and probably in 3 months to keep an idea on some parameters. And then after that, every 6 months to a year, depending on what type of disease process that you have going on. And this patient here is the poster child for not keeping still, and a doctor not paying attention to his patient postoperatively. This guy was a young dog. And we have this run at Purdue that actually in our ICU that has a window on it. And this dog woke up really nicely from anesthesia, but really quickly. And I didn't pay attention to where we were putting this dog. And all of a sudden, I'm walking down the hallway, and I see this dog actually standing up on this thing looking at me. And he's running around, and he's jumping up looking at me. He's running around like, that lead's coming out. Sure enough, the next morning, we take radiographs. Both of these leads, the atrial lead and the ventricular lead, are sitting here. The dog's heart rate is 40 beats a minute again. So we had to go back into this guy. So cage rest is very important for these dogs afterward. Other complications, we've only had one dog that's had an infection. Arrhythmias that needed treatment have occurred in 4 patients. We've had 3 lead dislodgements and 4 seromas, which we've learned to keep a bandage wrap on these guys for at least a week, and we've reduced that complication significantly. The lead dislodgements have all been from dogs that have had difficulty basically keeping confined for that month period of time. Balloon valvuloplasty. Balloon valvuloplasty is a technique that's been around for a while as far as using angiography, as I showed you, since the 70s. We use it for dilation of stenotic valves or vessels using a balloon tip catheter. It's become the treatment of choice, and I say to attempt, and I underline attempt, to relieve cardiovascular obstructions associated with pulmonic stenosis. And with pulmonic stenosis, this is probably the treatment of choice of these guys. The attempt is actually for subvalvular aortic stenosis because we don't really do a good job with stretching these guys out. This is just a nasty disease process that we're dealing with. We've also done a couple of dogs that have had tricuspid valve stenosis and core triatriatum dexter also in these patients. And basically what we have here is a balloon, this catheter here, we place between in an area of stenosis and dilate it open. And we use this wire guide to guide us where we need to be in the heart. So as a sort of review, pulmonic stenosis versus subaortic stenosis, kind of a review of the disease processes here. Definition of pulmonic stenosis is a pulmonic valve that has malformed. In dogs, it's usually not just a fused valve. Unlike in human medicine where it's just a fused valve and the valve is normal, dogs actually have a malformed or dysplastic valve. So that is also fused. So we can do something with the fusion part of that by ballooning them out, but that thickness to the valve remains in most cases. So most often what you find is that these murmurs stay present in these dogs, and it may stay as loud as they were, although we're finding in some of our patients that those murmurs are decreasing significantly. And I think we're probably just being a bunch of cowboys and being somewhat aggressive in the balloon sizes that we choose to really open that valve orifice up. Whereas subaortic stenosis tends to be a narrowing of the left ventricular outflow tract that tends to be fibrous or fibromuscular in nature, which hence gives us the problem in these guys, in that even when we balloon these, because of the fibrous area, it gets irritated when we balloon them. After about 4 to 6 months, that fibrous area orifice shrinks back down again, and you see that gradient rises up. The signalment for these dogs for pulmonic stenosis include English Bulldogs, Beagles, Keyshawns, Mastiffs, Miniature Schnauzers, and a Pug are probably the most common ones we see. For subaortic stenosis, Boxers, Golden Retrievers, German Shepherds, and Rotties, and Newfies are the most common. Physical exam findings, both diseases will have loud murmurs at the left heart base, with the inclusion of subaortic stenosis, especially severe cases of that, you'll have weak femoral pulses in those guys. Oftentimes, you can tell the severity of subaortic stenosis just by feeling the pulses. If the pulses aren't strong or they're very weak or sluggish, you probably have severe subaortic stenosis, and echoing is just going to confirm that for you. Let's see, I was going to play the type of murmur that we hear in these guys. I don't know if it's going to work. So kind of a rapid heart rate, but a systolic murmur only in these dogs. Now, excuse me. The difference between, in my mind, between pulmonic stenosis and subaortic stenosis is the sounding of that murmur. To me, that was more, if you listen to that, it sounds like somebody almost trying to cough up something with pulmonic stenosis. It's almost like a ho, 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 ho. Whereas subaortic stenosis tends to be a shoo, 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 shoo type of sound. So that's one of the ways I also differentiate those guys. When we look at pulmonic stenosis on echocardiography, and we can say this for both sides, but this is pulmonic stenosis patients, the pathology is such that we get right ventricular hypertrophy. You can see that this is an echocardiogram showing your left atrium, left ventricle, right atrium, right ventricle. You see that the thickness of the right ventricular free wall is as thick or thicker in this case than the left ventricular free wall, not normal. The other thing you should notice is that these hyperechoic areas in this myocardium, these are areas that are not getting perfused very well and thus can lead to arrhythmias and a number of the syncopal episodes that these animals may present with. This is just a short axis view of that same animal with a very thick myocardium. One of the things we do is spectral Doppler to assess the severity of these cases. And what we're measuring here is the pressure gradient between the right ventricular outflow tract here and the main pulmonary artery across this thick valve. And what we measure here is this velocity of how fast blood flows across here. Normally, it's about a meter to 1.5 meters per second. And this dog here, we're getting greater than 6 meters per second, which translates to way too much pressure. The right ventricle is probably creating, what is that, 36 times 4, what is that, 144 millimeters of mercury pressure during systole, higher than the main pulmonary artery. So that's actually probably 160 millimeters of mercury pressure in the right ventricle. Normal pressures in the right ventricle during systole is only about 20 to 25 millimeters of mercury. Okay? Whereas with subaortic stenosis, you get the same, it's true, but just the opposite side. The left side here is thick. You have a narrowed outflow tract. Oftentimes the valve is thick, but it's because of turbulent blood flow slamming up against that valve, not necessarily because the valve is malformed. Okay, that's a secondary effect most often in these cases rather than a primary effect. And we do the same thing on this side, measure the pressure gradient. Velocities, again, should only be about a meter per second coming out of the left side of the heart. But in this case, we're getting pressures. Let's see, we're up to about 7 on here. So we're getting pressures 156 millimeters of mercury pressure higher than systemic pressure. So that's over 270 millimeters of mercury pressure in the left ventricle. Okay, that's the pressure. What we're measuring is the gradient, the difference between those two. Procedures, you can see this very similar pictures to the pacemaker. For pulmonic stenosis, we enter into the jugular vein, or we do a basically percutaneous introducer that we put into the neck. We do an angiogram that shows a number of different things. One, you can see these thick muscles here. Most of the papillary, hypertrophied papillary muscles. You see this little radiolucent spot here. That's the valve moving on this dog. Very thick valve, but it's not opening. You have postsynaptic dilatation of your main pulmonary artery, and then you have your pulmonary arteries coming out here. We then insert, the other thing you can see, and it may be hard in the back to see this, is how thick this myocardial wall is from here all the way to here. So a very thick right ventricular free wall here. We then follow up by advancing a balloon tip catheter across this valve, based on it, using this wire as a guide that we've guided out. We exchanged a couple of catheters, put this balloon across there. We know where the balloon is based on the tips of these markers here. We can tell where we are. And you can see this waist as we're expanding the balloon, and then watch this waist pops open as we expand it past the point of diffusion of that valve. So it is sort of a violent procedure to some extent in that you're popping and disrupting that valve. But believe it or not, these dogs do very well. Rarely do we see any problems with these cases. So pulmonic stenosis, try to take these out for these meetings here, but our cost that produced about $1,500 to $1,700 total bill. The last one I did actually recently was right at $1,600 for this procedure. And this, so we've done a open heart procedure with this would have cost about $3,000 easily. Postoperatively, once again, these patients are monitored overnight. They're on antibiotics for 7 to 10 days. They're placed on beta blocker therapy and also to help reduce the tension in the myocardium between the myocardial cells to allow more oxygen flow during those areas. Also to lower the upper rates that the heart rate can get up to. That's when these animals tended to have a lot of arrhythmias. We perform an echocardiogram the next day to see what our results are. We also measure pressures while we're in the lab also. And usually what we go for is about a 50 to 60% reduction in our patients' gradients. And what we've seen, I've done this study, this was a study of our patients probably back in 2003, 2004. We had done 62 patients since my time at Purdue. And the average starting pressure gradient was 160, 159, 160 millimeters of mercury pressure in the right side of the heart. What we've seen initially after 1 month, we followed up with 55 of those patients, is that the pressure gradient stayed down from that initial drop to close to 40 millimeters of mercury. I think it's actually about 50, if I'm reading the slide correctly. And as we've monitored these patients over time, unfortunately only had 28 after a year. To me, that's a good sign, meaning that the owners are satisfied and the dogs are doing well. We only see only a slight rise in some of these patients. And these actually were probably skewed in that we had one patient that was probably closer back to his normal gradient, and that dog was actually a subvalvular pulmonic stenosis and not a valvular pulmonic stenosis, so he didn't do well. So we had a couple of patients that really skewed these numbers, so I think they're sliding up a little bit high. I think if we look at these numbers, those are pretty impressive over time. Subarachnoid balloon dilation occurs via the same similar method. However, we do a vascular cut down to the external carotid. Fluoroscopy guides us again, and we measure our pressure gradient again. And I'll just show you the ballooning just to save time here. Basically, so we have a catheter in our left ventricle here. And this, you notice we don't get that snappy opening to the balloon. We basically just stretch that balloon open. That's because we're dealing with a fibrous tissue rather than a valve that will pop open. We reserve this procedure for very severe cases. And in such, we've only done 5 of these cases at Purdue. And it's because we know we don't really do a good job at resolving their signs. We reserve it for cases that are very severe and having clinical signs of syncope associated with this disease process. We've done 3 2 of the dogs that died during the procedures. 3 of the dogs, the average gradient went from 237 millimeters of mercury to 92 millimeters of mercury at 1 month. We've rechecked 2 of these dogs, and we've maintained one of those over a year period of time with its gradient down. The other one started creeping back up to not quite to this level, but they were at 120 the last time we checked them. So expected results. However, in all 3 of those dogs, the clinical signs have resolved completely and are doing well. So we're happy with that. We're never happy that we have 2 of those dogs die during the procedure. As far as pulmonic stenosis is concerned, I forgot to mention, we've only had 3 cases of those die during the procedure, and we're well over 120 of those cases now. So really good results in that procedure. Transcatheter shunt occlusion has become one of the mainstays in veterinary medicine of catheter-based therapies. In humans, this is used for patent ductus arteriosus, ventricular septal defects, atrial septal defects, and atrial fistulas. In veterinary medicine, we've used this primarily for closure of patent ductus arteriosus. We've also used this for closure of atrial septal defects, and we were the first to actually use this to close an atrial septal defect in a dog. And we've also started using this method to close off portal systemic shunts. Patent ductus arteriosus is probably the most common congenital cardiac disease that you run across in dogs. It's a failure of the 6th left aortic arch, or left 6th aortic arch to close, and results in a shunting of blood away from the aorta into the pulmonary artery, resulting in left-sided volume overload. Poodles, German Shepherds, Collies, Pomeranians, Shetland Sheepdogs, Maltese, and Yorkies seem to be predisposed in our patients, poodles being the number one. Newfies also are a breed that should be up there. It's a big breed dog that gets PDA. On physical exam, as I'm shorting out my computer here, you have a loud, continuous murmur at the left heart base. You'll find these patients have hyperkinetic or bounding pulses. And animals may or may not be shunted and grow in their size. Majority of my patients don't really have stunted growth. We see pretty good-sized patients. They may have signs of congestive heart failure. See if I can stop this. It won't stop the runaway sounds. And one of the things I always talk to clients about when it comes to puppies and congestive heart failure is you may not notice that these dogs are breathing rapidly, but one of the main signs that you may see is that these dogs are stretching. Okay? They do an awful lot of stretching, and what they're trying to do is expand the thoracic cavity. I walked into a room one day with a client, and one of my main things I do is I don't pick up the dog, I tell them leave it where it is. And this dog was just sitting there, just kept stretching. And they said, you know, he's been doing that for a couple of weeks. I said, I think your dog's in congestive heart failure. That's one of the signs. This dog had a huge heart, basically taking up most of his thorax, had pulmonary edema, had a big PDA. Closed him off, he did well. Still had some systolic dysfunction down the line. But as far as I know, he's still doing well. But you have to be very aggressive in that patient. I don't know what we're doing here. Echocardiogram, one of the main views that we look at is this left heart-based view where you have the aorta in the middle, pulmonic valve here, your pulmonary artery coming here. The aorta is actually coming out at the screen at you here. This little vessel down here at the bottom is the PDA. This is becoming very important to us in that it allows us to measure the size of the PDA and also to decide type of device we're going to use. And that's very important now, because now we have choices of devices for PDA to close. On radiographs, the other thing you'll notice is the classic ductal bump here and pulmonary overcirculation. Your pulmonary arteries and veins are enlarged in these patients. Oops. So treatment of these dogs, the ductus must be closed. Most of them have an excellent prognosis with closure of the ductus. 50 to 70%, depending on the study that you read, will die within the first year of life if this ductus isn't closed in most of your patients. And once again, this was actually the first congenital defect to be closed surgically and by occlusion both ways. Surgical treatment is the gold standard. Results are excellent where you go in and ligate these patients. I did a study when I first got to Purdue that looked at the incidence of complications in these patients, and what we found is they had about a 7 to 10% incidence of complications, most of them being hemorrhage as the main complication of the ductus when they were trying to ligate it or dissect around it. And what I also noticed is that the incidence of complications tended to be higher when you were dealing with the first and second year resident as opposed to a third year resident or a clinician who knew what, you know, the case is. I mean, with everything, it takes a little bit of practice and you got to get good at it. Well, when I looked at PDA closure from our perspective of using catheter-based results at that time, we saw a very similar incidence of complications. Well, Dr. Hogan was my mentor, and he was hit first year out of his residency, and I'm a new guy shoving catheters, don't know what I'm doing. So, of course, our incidents were just as high as a first year resident, surgery residents. And what I've seen is that that has completely come down now that we've gotten a lot more experience at doing this. Our incidence of complications are probably around 3 to 5% in actuality in these patients. So, first off, do no harm. I think we've done a good job at doing that with our catheter-based procedures. The other thing with surgeries requires thoracotomy. Which increases the cost of hospital and the length of stay for these patients in the hospital. Unless you're dealing with some of the older surgeons like what is his name at Michigan State? I forgot his name just that quick. He basically can do these surgeries in about 15 minutes and they can go home probably the next day in these guys. So he's an old experienced guy and he kicked my butt for forgetting his name that quick, but. The main transcatheter-based methods that we have now, we have three main devices. The GeoTurco coils are the classical device. The Amplants vascular plug is something we worked with Amplants to use in these guys. And the Amplants canine PDA device is something Minnesota has worked with Amplants with to develop just specifically for dogs. The coils look like little coils, spring coils. They're double helix stainless steel spring coils that have Dacron fibers attached to them, and these fibers help develop a clot in the PDA. That clot develops, and then you basically stimulate the endothelial process of thrombus maturation and then endothelial growth over that PDA that was missing when the animal was born. This was first reported, used in 1995 by Matt Miller. It has a wide array of dimensions that we can use anywhere from 0.1 to 8 all the way up to 0.052 coils. They also have that's the inner wire diameter. They have an outer helical diameter ranging from 3 to 25 millimeters, which allows us to use them in various size PDAs. And the different lengths will allow us, the combination of the outer helical diameter and the length allows us to determine how many coils get put in the ductus. Ideally, you want to have about three coils that are sitting in the ductus for these patients. That doesn't always happen the way it should, unfortunately. Let's see if we can go back. The vascular plug, oops. The Amplants vascular plug is a self-expanding cylindrical device. Before I forget, one other thing about the coils is that there's two methods that we can use to put those in. One, we can hold on to the coil. However, that requires a patient that to be of a certain size. In smaller patients, we have to basically do a free release, which allows more coils to get embolized to the lungs, unfortunately. So that release method, we just push the coil out into the ductus. And if we mismeasured it or whatever, that coil may fly out into the lungs. And that happens to a lot of dogs and kids. They don't really have any secondary complications to it in actuality. And they've studied kids long-term with these and haven't had any problems with pulmonary hypertension as a result of that. The implant's vascular plug is a self-expandable cylindrical device that's made of a nitinol mesh. It is on a threaded delivery cable, which means that we can easily reposition this. And a size range anywhere from 4 to 16 millimeters. And this French system is the smallest French system that we can put this through. It's a 5 French system. So once again, a patient of a certain size we need to have in order to put this device in. However, with this device, the good thing about this device is that we can actually deliver it both transvenously or as well as transarterially, which means that even smaller dogs we can probably get this device into because the jugular veins expand very nicely and can expand most. We can get a 5 French system in most dogs, even very small ones. So this is a very good device for these patients. And I'll show you some results of that in a minute. The other device was the Implant's canine PDA occluder that was developed. It's another self-expanding nitinol mesh that has a distal flat disc that spans across the PDA into the pulmonary artery, followed by a larger proximal cup that conforms to the shape of most dog PDAs. So this is why this works so well for these guys. And then it has this inner waist that kind of collapses on each other to hold it in place. Again, on a threaded delivery cable, which allows it to be repositionable if you're not satisfied with it. Ranges in size from 3 to 14 millimeters. Again, it takes a 5 French system. The problem with this system as it currently is made, which I've emailed them to tell them they need to turn this system around so we can put it in transvenously also in smaller dogs, right now it can only be delivered via transarterial routes, and that requires the femoral artery. Again, size becomes a major limitation in these patients. Whenever we do a PDA, the first thing we do is we do an angiogram in these patients. We have a little pigtail catheter in the aorta in this case. We do an angiogram and what you're seeing here is the PDA itself lighting up and dye flowing directly from the aorta into the main pulmonary artery right here. Okay? This allows us to measure the size and shape of the device a little bit more accurately than echocardiogram. Once we get an idea of the size and shape, this is the typical ones that we've seen in dogs. Form 2A and 2B are the most common two types that we see. Type 2A, especially in small dogs, allows us to just pop a coil in pretty easily. This morphology is also the one that ductal occluder is probably best suited for. Type 2B probably is best for that implant's plug because you don't have that expanded cup. It conforms to the shape of the ductus, where you have a very narrow, kind of evenly shaped ductus here. It doesn't have that kind of funnel-shaped appearance. And then type 3 is the problematic ones. These are most commonly seen in German Shepherds. These are non-restrictive PDAs. You see this very wide PDA that doesn't come down to any shape, which is part of the reason why we started looking at these other devices to try to fix these German Shepherds. However, we send most of these dogs to surgery now. Still, even with these devices, most of these guys go to surgery. However, what we found with surgery is that sometimes they don't close them off all the way, but it creates a perfect anatomy for us to go back and stick a coil in. So we've done that in about 5 cases, actually, when the surgery hasn't worked perfectly for these guys. Once we've done that, measured our size, we implant our device. At the top, we have our coil being implanted. We're actually implanting a coil, in this case, with a biotome that actually holds on to the coil. These biotomes used to be fairly cheap. Now they've made them only one-use devices. We can't reuse them very much. They get stuck together. So the cost of these are about $400. So that took the cost of the procedure up about $300 to $400 to try to cover the cost of these devices. The coils themselves only cost about $35 to $50. So it became a lot more expensive technique. Here we have the plug being delivered, and what you're seeing here is unscrewing of a plug and basically sitting in place nicely. And then we have unscrewing of the implant's ductal device here, canine ductal device, sitting in place nicely. We do a follow-up angiogram. And here you see the PDA with the coil. Of course, we show you the perfect one. that only require one coil, but oftentimes we have problems and you need one, more than one coil in these guys. What you're seeing is ductal flow being occluded here in the aorta. You're seeing the aorta light up a lot more and ductal flow is occluded, no flow going into the main pulmonary artery. Same is true here for the ductal occluder. Excuse me, the plug device. We're injecting dye directly into the PDA. We see no flow going across that device. Here, in this case, we have the implant occluder. You see this dog is having still a little bit of residual flow. That closed off over 24 hours. When we echoed this dog, there was no flow across this device, and that's very common with these guys. Most often, actually, we see no flow in these patients. PDAs, postoperatively, they're monitored overnight. They get an echo the next morning, antibiotics for a week, recheck in a month. If they're completely closed off, we don't really need to see them again. I'm following up some of these patients a little bit to see what the device is looking like down the line, years down the line. I contact them and see if they want to come in and get a free echo, make sure the device is working fine, make sure the heart function is normal. And we're finding that they're doing just great with these devices. And we have patients that have been out six years now at least. So we're very happy with the way these devices are working. If you look at outcomes in these patients, we have back in 2003 was the last count that I took of coils. We've probably done well over this number right now, even with coils, even with the advent of these new devices. 73 cases, we had positive outcomes in 63 out of the 73 that we attempted. These 73 at the time were very small. A lot of these seven cases were very tiny dogs that we couldn't get access into the femoral artery. And then we developed a technique that actually we can do them in very small dogs. We found catheters that were small enough to get in and did a free release in these dogs. And we have a paper out that about that in Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine. And the smallest dog we've done now has been 0.9 kilograms. Actually, we did a 0.7 kilogram dog about 2 months ago. So that's beat our record. And we just dropped a coil into these guys. The biggest problem that we've had besides the size of the patient is the type 3 ductus. We attempted 3 out of 5 of these dogs. We closed 2 of these dogs, and both of them required multiple coils. I'll tell you, our highest number of coils that we put in a dog was 9 over 2 procedures. We put 4 in one and 5 in the next procedure to close them off. We were out of our minds. That made no sense, to be honest with you. But we started the procedure and got stuck into it and had to close them off, so we went back in and closed them off. We've learned our lesson. You go to surgery now if you have that type of ductus, as far as we're concerned. Patient size is a limitation. The device cost has, like I said, jumped up depending on what type of device system we use to place it. If we use free release, it's fairly cheap. It costs about $50, just the cost of the coil, probably another $100 for the catheter. The device, if we have to use a bioptone to hold on to it, as we do in larger dogs, it's going to jump that cost up over $350, $400. The plug device we've done, and these are late numbers because we have probably over 35 of these dogs now. We've done, at the time, we had did 22 dogs. We had an outcome of success in 20 out of the 22 dogs. Complications, we had two dogs that had what we call persistent flow through this device. These were one of the first two dogs we did. Actually, the first three dogs that we did, we had one dog that the thing started spinning in there. And I can't find. I think Dr. Hogan actually was doing that surgery, and he hid that video of it. I was going to show it. Well, that's kind of scary. We all sitting there going, "Oh God, this is not good." Well, that was in a learning process. We were learning how to size the device accurately. Once we figured out that, we haven't had much problems. And this 20 has probably come on a later end of that. Once again, morphology is a big problem. Type 3 ductus seems to be a problem. The first one that we did embolized, and we've successfully done one type 3. We don't know if that's going to work in all these patients. The problem with it is that this holds into place basically by expansion. Okay? So if you don't have anything that's expanded long enough in these big wide ductus, you're not going to get good purchase, and you're going to lose that device into the lungs. This is actually an incorrect device cost. It was $400. They've given it to Infinity Medical, and they've actually lowered the price of this device to $250 compared to $400. So we're very happy with this because a lot of our dogs are completely amenable to this device. The canine clue device, we've only done five dogs. We had five out of five successful cases. No complications so far, but we haven't tried any type 3 dog test. Patient size is going to be the limitation of being able to use this device, as you got to get a certain size system. And the cost is a little bit higher at $500, $550 for a device. It still only raises the cost totally of the procedure to about $2,000 from us. If you're in private practice, if you're doing this somewhere else here in California, it's probably going to be looking at $3,000 somewhere to do that to do this procedure completely. So coils and plugs are probably going to be the main things that are going to stick out in a lot of these guys. Limitations, again, the large type 3 ductus with the non-restrictive morphology and patient size are going to be the main limitations to us doing that. Patient size, even if you ask surgeons, they don't really like doing very tiny dogs in these patients. Other catheter-based procedures that we're doing, something that may actually that we're working on right now is temporary cardiac pacing via the esophagus. And we're doing this in dogs primarily, but this has been a common thing in humans, especially in children, where we place an electrophysiologic catheter into the esophagus to capture the heart. We've shown good preliminary data to capture the atria, but because of the anatomy of dogs, we can't capture the ventricles. Well, you guys are saying, well, why would you still use this? Well, how many of you guys have these dogs that may be a sick sinus dog that you're scared to put under anesthesia or do a dental with? Everybody raise their hand because everybody's had that. Well, this device is something that actually may be amenable to be used in referral practice. It's just like placing an NG tube. You place it down there, and these pacers you can get on eBay for $20 to $50. We bought three of them for $175. And the catheters you can get from any hospital. So if we're in the process of perfecting this technique. And what you're seeing is, in this case, what we did in this study was actually assess esophageal damage using this, pacing these dogs. This is the pacemaker in the esophagus. And what you see is a pace impulse followed by a P wave for the QRS in these patients. So those guys, where we're worried about bradycardia and non-responsiveness to our sympatholytics or our parasympatholytics, this may be a device that can be used very easily. And what we're studying right now is seeing how fast our students can put these in and capture the hearts. And we're finding that they're pretty dang good at it, actually. So, once again, something that we may actually be able to get out in private practice for you guys to use very easily for those patients who are at risk for developing problems. Balloon pericardectomy, I showed you guys a little bit earlier. We've done 7 cases with these guys. Haven't had any recurrences as of yet. We've had them die secondary to pleural effusion advancement. Portal systemic shunts, and this is an inaccurate number here. We're actually up to 10 of these cases now where we've closed off portal systemic shunts. And we do a procedure called a cranial mesenteric arteriogram, something that's actually an older procedure to kind of diagnose the portal systemic shunt. And this is something we started doing to help our surgeons out instead of basically doing ultrasound. These guys, we just catheterized the femoral artery, and instead of having to do an intra-surgical portogram, we just catheterized the artery, see flow come into the portal vein, and then go into our shunt. The most common is the single extrahepatic shunt, which you're seeing here, coming from our portal vein connecting to our caudal cava. We also see portal esophagus type shunts. Here's a portal vein coming up, the shunt vessel going into the esophagus vein, emptying into the cranial cava, in the caudal thoracic cava. We've also seen multiple acquired diseases, and the single intrahepatic shunts have been common. And what we've done in these patients, and I can't show you this device, is we have a device that closes off partially blood flow, but still allows some flow to go through. So if you look at this vessel here, this is your shunt vessel right here. Here's your device sitting here. You still see some small amount of flow going into the caudal cava. But in this patient, before we did this angiogram, you saw no portal flow going into the liver. These vessels right here are actually portal flow that's opening up. Over time, this closes off in these dogs. And if it doesn't close off, we can come back with one of those plug devices and close them off pretty quickly. And we've done 10 of these dogs. We've done 6 of them with this particular device, and we've done 4 of them with actually just closing off the plug. What we do in those cases, we temporarily occlude the shunt with a balloon, see if they have any signs of developing portal hypertension. If they don't, we close them off. And these dogs have done very well. The longest we have out right now is about 8 months. So we're still seeing how they're doing. But 8 months without portal hypertension, they're probably going to not develop any problems in these guys long term. So one of the things we are curious to see is how many of them actually develop other shunts or develop shunts down the line. The other things we've done is actually close off renal vessels in idiopathic hematuria patients. We've done this in three patients, two successfully completely resolving the hematuria in these patients. And we go in, what we do is we selectively occlude each of these vessels while Dr. Adams, our urinary guy, is looking at the ureters to see if the hematuria stops. And if it does, we put a coil in those guys, close them off, and if he watches them for a little while. And if the hematuria is resolved, we wake them up, see how they do. This particular patient is one of the ones that didn't, the one that didn't work. This dog had actually AV fistula. So we went back and did an angiogram on this dog. We saw that these vessels were closed off, but he developed collaterals around all the rest of these vessels. So he probably had AV fistula malformations in the end, in that patient. So, my slides are not doing what they're supposed to do here, but, let's see. In the end, transcatheter occlusion of our patients is a very vital part of our patient care interventional procedures. They tend to be less invasive and less expensive than other therapeutic techniques. It continues to evolve as a specialty to some extent. Even in radiology, you develop an interventional radiologist. There's one who's training at Penn right now is into interventional radiology. And we'll see that these techniques will continue to advance. And once again, it remains this process remains an integral part of cardiology, even though its use of as a diagnostic tool has declined. But most important, it's very important for you to know what techniques are out there, what things are coming up the pipeline, so that you can sit back and talk with your clients about what we're doing and actually counsel them in the direction they need to go with their patients and these guys. And just thank you for listening. This is our ASD patient here who is Bijou Goodwin and actually doing very well right now. We implanted this. This dog had a huge ASD. Probably was going to develop heart failure. Had a huge right heart before we did this. And now he's doing very well. So, and this was about 3 years ago. So he's still doing well. Any questions? Thank you very much.